Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Exits Closed. My guest today is Robert Maripol, who is the son of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. And Robert is going to talk about COVID-19, the present, and other things that are happening in America today. So it's been a little while since we talked, Robert. The last time we talked, did the coronavirus hit, or was that before the pandemic really made the news? You remember?
I think we had a plan to talk after the coronavirus hit, and then it hit, and it kind of changed everything, and we postponed our conversation. But, you know, I'm not. So I think the last time we talked was probably in early February before anything happened. But I don't trust my memory entirely. Everything has changed since then.
And the whole world is turned upside down. So I'm sure that you've been watching and listening to what the president has been doing and saying, and you know, in view of your history of the people around him, what do you think of President Trump right now?
Well, I mean, I think that, I mean, when you, I just want to say, so it's not too cryptic for your listeners, that my niece Ivy, we were just talking about this, Cynthia, has a documentary out called Bully, Coward, Victim about Roy Cohn. Of course, Roy Cohn was really the engineer, one of the principal engineers of my parents' frame-up, and in particular the execution of my mother, Ethel Rosenberg. But he was also Donald Trump's lawyer and mentor, and taught Donald Trump his fighting style. So that's what, when you talk about people around Trump, how, you know, I feel a sense of special connection, negative connection through that. So I see kind of a straight line from my parents' execution to Donald Trump's presidency. And so what do I think of him now? You know, I think that, of course, the whole acknowledgement of the body politic of the country, of systemic racism that has happened in response to, you know, all the police brutality directed against primarily African Americans, but also others as well, and that's another aspect of what's going on that has made it more difficult for Trump. But to focus particularly on the virus, you know, I think that there were two main signals in my mind that came out in the last couple of weeks that sort of provide, I think, an overview of where we stand. And that is that as we look at Trump's entirely failed effort to contain the virus, and I say Trump's because it's really by not creating any sort of national coordinated program, without taking charge of this, without listening to the scientists, with instead trying to downplay everything for political purposes and simultaneously shirk any responsibility for doing anything about it, and therefore putting it on the governors. We've created this patchwork response, and since he cares more about re-election and he knows that the economy has to bounce back if he's going to get re-elected, in order to enable him to be re-elected, I should say. Well, given that, he's going to do everything he can to downplay how the virus is doing, but it doesn't work because the virus doesn't listen to him. And the result is the explosion in the states of that where the governors have supported his general line of attack has created a situation where more and more people are saying, you know, we should be thinking of this perhaps as the Trump plague, not as the coronavirus, because the reality is the national failure to deal with that first wave that came in March into April. It's that failure and his policies that are producing the second, even bigger wave. And so it really is fair to think about this as the Trump plague. And I think a lot of people are thinking that way. And the result is his support is crumbling. But there is another danger. And that is that, you know, he's basically saying, either I'm going to win this election, or if I don't win this election, it's because of fraud, because I really won the election. So in other words, he's basically saying, I'm going to claim that I win the election no matter what happens. And if that's the case, he might refuse to leave no matter what happens. And that's where I come to where I started this long, you know, aside. And that is that in the last couple of weeks, there have been a couple of events that I think provide handwriting on the wall to what might happen if Trump refuses to leave. One is the Supreme Court's two decisions that went against Trump, with John Roberts siding with the liberals. And of course, John Roberts, I don't know if you know this, Cynthia, but the Supreme Court just struck down Louisiana
for abortion.
And that John Roberts wrote, who sided with the liberals again. I think this is an indication that if Trump refuses to leave, a majority of the Supreme Court will say he must leave. He's not going to win at the Supreme Court level like in the Bush v. Gore case. And second of all the Joint Chiefs of Staff people coming out, the ones who've retired, and General Mattis and various others coming out and essentially attacking Trump, I think that indicates that he doesn't have the military with him. In fact, I believe the military would be much happier with a Biden presidency than a Trump presidency. Biden is certainly enough of a hawk, particularly when it comes to Russia, that they are going to be more supportive of him. And so if you put that together, you see that even if Trump refuses to leave, I think the forces that are going to be arrayed against him will make it impossible for him to stay. That said, it is a little nervous-making to be reliant on Chief Justice Roberts and the Joint Chiefs of Staff to preserve state. I mean, Joint Chiefs of the Army to preserve what's left of our extremely tattered democracy. That is nervous-making, but I think that's the situation.
Do you think because Roberts is coming down more on the left and on the right, and he's some of the decisions, but this was early on with the ACA, so what's happening now is not really a surprise to anybody. But as Trump learns about these Supreme Court decisions and Roberts siding with the more liberal members of the Supreme Court, you think that makes him nervous?
Yeah, I think it does. I think, are you asking me if it makes Trump nervous or Roberts nervous?
Trump.
Yeah, I think it does make Trump nervous. One of the things that's hard to tell, Cynthia, is how in touch with reality is this guy? And let me give you an example. One of the things that autocrats do and that Donald Trump has done and has now done for 3.5 years is he surrounds himself with yes men, with people who tell him what he wants to hear. who don't really disagree with him. And the result is that, you know, you recall before the first Iraq war, I mean, the second Iraq war, that, you know, Saddam Hussein was talking about the mother of all battles, and all his generals were telling him that he was going to be able to resist the United States and all this. And he lived in this world of illusion. And, you know, it didn't last more than 48 hours before he had to go into hiding. And the same is kind of true with Donald Trump and his Tulsa rally. You know, all the people around him were telling him, there are going to be a million people. We're going to have to set up a supplemental stage. We're going to do all this, you know, and then look what happened when the reality hit. It was a disaster. And so how much Trump has figured out that he's facing a disaster, that unless there's a vaccine, unless there's not going to be an economic recovery, and if there's no economic recovery and no vaccine and the virus continues to surge because he has no plan to combat it, he doesn't have a chance in hell of winning. The only chance he has is to get a vaccine and to have the economy recover, and that's not going to happen between now and November. And you know, whether he's probably clinging to that hope. And if he's totally divorced from reality, he may retain that hope. But if he's got some sense of reality, it's going to be more and more difficult for him to cling to it.
But let me ask you this. You're saying to me that you think that Trump at this point is delusional. I want to say the leadership in the Democratic Party is just as delusional, because they're promoting the same old thing that they have in the past, which made them lose elections. They're not innovative. They're not bold. And, you know, you're thinking it's a given that Trump will possibly lose the election. But in my mind, I'm not so sure, because Biden is tied into the leadership of the Democratic Party, and they're asleep at the wheel. What do you think?
Well, I do agree with you. I think that first of all, nothing is certain. All sorts of things can happen between now and November. You know, all I can do is sort of extrapolate from where we are now. But, you know, of course, I mean, I think, first of all, aside from the fact that Biden is, you know, tied in to the Democratic mainstream and the Democrats are quite capable of blowing things. And also because, I mean, you know, Biden has the charisma of a cardboard box. You know, so there's all sorts of problems with his candidacy, but I think there's a political current that's running through the American public, and a lot of the electorate. And that is, people are frightened. People are scared. They're scared of the virus. They're scared of the economy. They're scared of all the violence, the police violence. They're scared of machine gun toting neo fascists invading state capitals. They're scared of all those things. And Biden, boring as he is, and status quo as he is, provides a level of comfort to frightened people. So I think the fact that the polls keep showing him going inching further and further ahead and Trump falling further and further behind, even though young people are not enthusiastic for Biden, even though there's all sorts of, you know, a Biden presidency is quite problematic in its own way, even with all those things, I think that the climate has moved in a direction that make it much more likely that Biden will be elected. Now, of course, that's what we say at the end of June. We'll just have to see what it's like at the end of October. But, you know, right now, unlike, you know, we've been talking about this for a long time, and right now for it's not so far in the future anymore. It's getting close. And so while I understand and sort of agree with a lot of what you're saying about the Democrats, but I think in this situation, right now, you know, in my mind, it's looking like it's not even going to be close. Now, that said, you can't rest on your laurels. You can't. And I think the most important thing for us to be doing is supporting the demonstrations that are going on, continuing the agitation around Trump, you know, advocating for a science-oriented and public health oriented to the virus, and also pushing for the kind of economic stimulus that will go to the people who need it most rather than the corporations. You know, we have to bail out the post office. The states are in desperate shape. There are things that need to be done with, you know, a lot of people have been surviving on extra unemployment checks that will run out at the end of July. And if that's not dealt with, there are going to be millions of people who go into food insecurity come August. And so we are facing some, you know, in other words, when I look at, when I try to project forward for the next 4 months, July through October, I see a lot of chaos. I see a lot of damage being done. I see a lot of people hurting. And I think, and everybody is on edge. That is a very dangerous formula. You know, it is a hopeful, but in some ways, terrifying time that we face.
Do you think that this year is more, I don't even know the word I should use, but do you think it's worse than 1968 when, you know, King and Kennedy was killed and there was violence in the street and Chicago was a mess? Do you think we're in worse shape now than we were in 68?
Well, I think we're in worse shape in the fact that, you know, in 68 was a time of relative economic prosperity. A lot of the violence that was happening in 68, you know, were brought out by the people, middle-class white kids in colleges rebelling. Now, of course, there were also African-American uprisings, and they didn't partake equally in the prosperity of the late 1960s. But what you have now is you have 50 million-plus people unemployed, people out of work. The people who are in the streets demonstrating are not well-to-do college students. They're desperate members of the younger generation who are being left further and further behind. And so I think it is, for a lot of people, it is a much worse situation. Now, of course, not for the people who were fighting in Vietnam in 60, you know, not for the hundreds of thousands of soldiers there, and certainly not for the Vietnamese who were, you know, being napalmed and having Agent Orange spread all over the country. So, you know, it's when you start comparing eras, it's always very complex, and generalizations, you know, have limited value. But I do think that if we focus on the domestic situation here in the United States, it is actually a lot worse. And, you know, what's a little bit personally frustrating for me, and I think probably for a lot of people of my generation who've got my political sympathies, is we're scared to go out in the streets. You know, where there's been I live in Western Massachusetts, and there have been plenty of demonstrations in my town.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I feel like so isolated, being unable to be out there and giving the support that I wish I could. And I think that there are a lot of people of my generation who are feeling the same way. And so we feel removed from what is going on. And that may insulate us a bit from how bad it is. But, you know, a lot of these demonstrations are not coming from lost hope and frustration, but from desperation and true rage. And so I think the situation on a national level is more volatile today than it was in 68.
On New Year's Day 2020, did you even fathom the way 2020 has been unfolding?
No. And you know, none of us did. None of us did. And, you know, I kind of, I remember thinking during the SARS virus years ago that this could be the beginning of the end, that it's going to spread. And I have a good friend who's a professor of the history of public health, who I've talked with over the years, who has said repeatedly, you know, we are so vulnerable to a pandemic. It is going to happen. This is coming. And I said, oh, that's terrifying, you know, and I just put it aside. And, you know, I kind of am kicking myself when I think about the first news dribbling out in December and January. None of us, you know, yeah, I think there were public health people who were sounding the alarm, but nobody was listening to them. But there were plenty of us who were relatively knowledgeable about this, who could have said, mm-hmm. wait a second, This is what's coming down the pike, and it's terrifying, and we better prepare for it. And yet, I think it's just human nature. It was just almost too upsetting to contemplate, so we did nothing. And then it caught us by surprise. And I'm not talking about, when I say we, the Trump administration and their politics. I'm just talking about average people who could have seen the handwriting on the wall, but didn't.
And there are still many people who are in denial and think this is all fake. What do you tell them?
Well, you know, I don't. The people who think it's fake, I don't think you can get through to them. I think the only thing we'll get through to them is when their relatives start dying. You know, we've seen so many stories of people leading the reopen movement who then test positive for COVID. You know, and we hear stories about people who have big family get-togethers and then all their relatives come down with it and a couple of them die and then they regret what they did. And, you know, the more and more that happens, the harder and harder it will be for people to remain in denial. But denial and wishful thinking is a very, very powerful force. It is really difficult to overcome. And so I think that it's unfortunately going to continue. And one of the things that seems to me to have been obvious, and especially now that more than a month has gone by since all the demonstrations about George Floyd took place, huge numbers of people came relatively close together, even in, you know, packed tightly, but they were outside and they were wearing masks. And what mm-hmm. have we discovered? That the cities where those big demonstrations took place have not spiked. That it's beginning to look like the social distancing, you know, the hand washing and the being at least 6 feet away from other people, it's beginning to look like the component of that, that is the mask wearing, is the most important single thing we can do. And yet it is amazing how resistant, you know, what I find amazing is not the people who resist it for ideological reasons. You know, their politics tell them that wearing a mask is a bad thing. And they have this ideology and they're going to promote that it has something to do with freedom. You know, I think it has nothing to do with freedom. It has everything to do with death. And essentially these, I think of these demonstrators as death demonstrators. And it's, you know, where has this country come to that we have dozens, hundreds, even thousands of Trump supporters demonstrating for death? I mean, really. In any event, these people, those people, they're not going to change. And there's nothing you can do about them in terms of wearing a mask. But then there are all these people who do agree with the science. But, you know, the mask, oh, you know, I'm going for a run and it's hot and it's uncomfortable and I can avoid other people. And so I don't need to wear a mask. And we find that all over the place. And, you know, I think of it as maskophobia, that, you know, these people who, you know, rationalize their way around their failure, their not, you know, their reasons not to wear a mask, you know, they're essentially saying my inconvenience is more important than your health. And, you know, it makes me feel like Americans have been so focused on their individual benefits and so selfish in their worldview and so narcissistic that, you know, they consider their inconvenience more important than other people's lives. And that, you know, that's kind of pathetic. You know, I can't help but thinking that those people are basically acting like a bunch of babies. And I know that I'm sure there'll be some people listening to this who will be insulted by that. But the fact that they could be spreading death and disease, and yet they're still acting to deal with their convenience, I mean, I find that appalling.
Well, you know,
so
Robert, on that note, we've got to close. So, of course, this conversation will be continued. So you've been listening to All Eggs Close with Robert Maripol, and I'm Cynthia Pooler. If you like this show, like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Thanks. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Have a good day, and thank you, everybody, for listening.
And thank you, Cynthia. I look forward to our next conversation.